So our first speaker is Seth, is it Bloomberg or Blumberg? Bloomberg, okay, who says he is a research physician based at the Francis I. Proctor Foundation at UCSF, which is the University of California, San Francisco, for those of you who don't know what that stands for. He studies weakly transmitting diseases that are either at risk of emerging or on the brink of elimination. Examples include measles, trachoma-induced blindness, and monkeypox. He is also interested in the unintended consequences of public health interventions, such as how antibiotic protocols impact the emergence of drug resistance. He is new to the APHA and excited to learn from everyone. Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Is there a pointer?
No.
No pointer. Okay. I guess, yeah, you heard that was a nice introduction.
Thanks. Speak
into the microphone. I'm Seth. I'm at UC San Francisco, and today I want to talk about some work we've been doing with measles. And to start, just to acknowledge my collaborators at the Proctor Foundation in San Francisco, where the focus is on infectious and inflammatory diseases, particularly of the eye. I've been working with Travis Porco, Thomas Liebman, and Wayne and Noria, the great people to work with. And the stuff I'm going to talk about today builds upon some work I did with Jamie Lloyd Smith at UCLA. I'm funded through the NIH and the Department of Homeland Security, and in particular through the MIDAS Modeling of Infectious Disease Agent Studies. So that's kind of two big themes of this talk. One is I want to talk about measles in the U.S. over the past 10 years, but the other is to talk sort of more generally about an approach to looking at weakly transmitting diseases or subcritical diseases, meaning the effective reproductive number is between 0 and 1. So the idea here is that do folks know about effective reproductive number? Can you raise your hand if that's new? Some people do, some people don't. Okay, so the effective reproductive number is if someone gets infected, on average, how many people will they infect? So if it's large, then you're going to get sustained transmission, a big epidemic like flu. If it's less than 1, then on average, infections will die out. So in these sort of weakly transmitting diseases, if you will, the idea is there's some reservoir of infection in some primary population, and then there'll be a transmission event that introduces that infection to a new population. So in the case of measles, the reservoir are, you know, for the U.S. is foreign countries, Africa, where the vaccination isn't high, and then someone will travel or someone will come into the U.S. and introduce a measles case to the U.S., and then you get, so that's in the red, and then from the red you might get some transmission events within the U.S. We kind of think of them as stuttering chains, but because the R effective is less than 1, they will become extinct. There's just not enough transmissibility for them to become endemic, thankfully. And so that as a kind of model you can think of in terms of different diseases. I just talked about how this can be applied to vaccine-preventable diseases, but you can also think of it in terms of smaller population units. So, for example, nosocomial infections where you get community importation into a hospital, then hospital-to-hospital spread, or later, I guess we're going to learn about household transmission. So in that case, the household can be the secondary population. Or what I've worked a lot on is zoonotic diseases, where you get the primary, so the infectious reservoir is in animals, and then you get animal-to-human transmission as an introduction. So the data for looking at a stuttering chain transmission, stuttering chains in a weakly transmitted disease looks something like this. It's quite simple. You can just make a table of all the different little infectious clusters and how big they are. And our goal here is to learn as much as we can from this kind of data. So how do we do that? We have our model of stuttering chains where we just assign a probability distribution for the number of cases each case will cause. Then you can apply branching process theory and get, based on the parameters for your offspring distribution, you get a chain size distribution. Apply maximum likelihood and you can get information on effective reproductive number, the dispersion parameter, which tells you about the transmission heterogeneity. And from those, you get information on the average chain size. Oh, I went right to the beginning. Average chain size and the probability of having a large chain, say at least three cases. I mentioned that the key is this offspring distribution for the probability of that a case for how many cases will be caused by a new case. And we use a negative binomial distribution. What that allows us is to modify both the strength and variability of transmission. So in the purple, which is the bottom curve, is the most homogeneous kind of transmission. And from there, you see that the coefficient of variance, which is plotted on the y-axis, is the lowest. But if you allow the dispersion parameter to be smaller, which means that there's more of a chance for super spreaders, where one case causes a large amount of transmission, then then you get more variation in disease. And so applying this theory to measles in the U.S., this is what we get. So that top line that's with some of the dash is homogeneous transmission, and it shows the relationship for homogeneous transmission between the average chain size and the probability of outbreak on the left axis. So the probability of outbreaks to having at least three cases, and using our maximum likelihood, that dark blue confidence region is what we find for the U.S. And that sits significantly below the longer lines, which is just indicating that we see a high degree of transmission heterogeneity, meaning that there's some cases are causing a disproportionate amount of the transmission. And that has implications if you think about vaccine coverage, because it means that it actually matters who's getting vaccinated. If you can target the super spreaders, then you get better bang for the buck, because you can reduce the overall transmissibility more than is proportional to vaccine coverage. So, interestingly, that gray curve on top is what the previous estimates have been, and that is based on a model that does not include transmission heterogeneity. And on the right, in the inset, you see how, so there's the gray model on top, and the blue model that we use it's on the bottom, and that matches the data really well. And the reason why there's such a discrepancy is because previous efforts had ignored isolated cases. They said it's too difficult to measure the number of isolated cases, and so we're not even going to include them in the model. And that's fair enough. I'll come back to this plot. But what we found is that if you allow heterogeneity, then it's important to consider isolated cases. There's other ways to incorporate the impact of imperfect observation. And the reason that isolated cases are important is that over here, I'm plotting the relationship between R effective and the average chain size. If you assume you see all cases, then that's the black line, it's completely independent of the amount of transmission. But once you start censoring the data and say, what's the average chain size only when you look at chains that are having at least two cases, then there's a dependence on the dispersion, on the amount of heterogeneity. And so by improperly modeling the transmission heterogeneity, you lead to a bias. So coming back to this figure, what that implies is that our alternative approach is just to consider an independent observation probability, and then we can adjust directly based on our model the impact of imperfect observation. That's what you're seeing in the light blue that's slightly shifted from the dark blue. And that's actually a much smaller shift than the other approach where you just ignore isolated cases. And it overlays that on the right in the inset, that's actually the light blue. That's plotting. It's basically indistinguishable whether you look at the projections for the dark blue or the light blue in terms of the matching to data. Okay. So that kind of summarizes where we're at with the data. The next step is like, okay, what are the implications in terms of elimination? You know, measles was declared eliminated in 2000 in the U.S. Are we in a safe zone, or are we? Do we still have to, you know, worry about drops in vaccine coverage? And sure enough, it's very sensitive. We're finding a lot of sensitivity to vaccine coverage. So that again, we have that blue, which is the baseline data, and if vaccine coverage drops just by 1%, we project you move to this purple curve, and by 2% to the red curve, where you really have the potential for huge increases in the average change size, and thus the measles case burdens. So then we say, okay, well, let's look to see whether there's any concern for increasing measles burden. And here's just a plot of the number of measles from 1997 to 2011. The blue, so that vertical line is where measles was eliminated. The magenta line is looking just after elimination. There's a trend by linear regression that statistically significant that suggests that, whoa, maybe measles is increasing. But that's, so then, you know, the first thought is, are we in this regime of increased transmissibility? But we have to be a little bit careful in terms of thinking what are the contributions to the overall burden of measles? And there's two components. One is the number of introductions, from outside the U.S. And the second is the transmissibility are effective. And this just shows that if the transmissibility is high, then the introductions is low, and vice versa. So there's a negative correlation. And so what it makes sense then to do is look at instead of just trending number of measles cases, think about each of those contributions separately. So if you look at the introductions, it definitely seems to be a significant trend in the linear regression. But if you look at our effectives, so the transmissibility, that looks relatively stable. There's enough, we can't say with certainty, I mean, the error bars are quite high, and so there might be an increase, but there's definitely no statistical significance. And so that is kind of one of the key messages, just to think, for these weakly transmissible diseases, to think about the two stages, of both the primary infections and what causes those, and then the secondary infections. All right, two more slides. Am I okay on time? Again, just kind of trying to summarize, you know, for both measles, monkeypox, all these weakly transmitting diseases, vaccine-preventable diseases, nosocomial infections. I hope this talk just kind of provided a perspective on how you can use chain size analysis to look at both the strength and variability of transmission. And for measles in particular, despite the apparent rise in the number of measles cases in 2013, looks actually so far like there's going to be even more. The data, at least I have, is suggesting that that's not necessarily indicative of increased transmission, but rather increased importation. It kind of links national health to global health. But at the same time, it shows that, you know, we need to continue surveillance as is, despite elimination, because of the sensitivity to vaccine coverage. So in terms of future directions, I'm looking to, and I would love input and help on all of this, I'm looking to incorporate more data-driven models of imperfect observation and think more carefully about the heterogeneity, what's causing it. Is it person-to-person, or is it chain size to chain size, you know, as you would expect from pockets of immunity. And and then think about in turn how those different mechanisms of heterogeneity impact the relationship between vaccine coverage and transmissibility. And if you have, I'll take questions, but that's my contact if anyone has further questions down the line. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Yes.
How big is the chain of transmission in airplanes today? How big is the chain of transmission in airplane setting?
In the airplane setting?
Yeah. We usually would follow up with those cases within 2 rows of the index case. Would it be any different in an airplane?
I'm just trying to understand. So
it looks like, for example, if you're flying, you're 6 hours in the next location,
yeah.
You're 20 centimeters far away, highly contagious. Is the reproductive number going to be higher?
Okay.
Does it make any difference within 2 rows of the index case
versus
10 rows ahead?
Yeah, hopefully that'll answer your question. But so the question, just for the recording, is think about transmission in the airplane and how that is incorporated into chain size analysis. Is that fair enough?
Yeah.
So I think that comes down more to a potential mechanism for super spreading and heterogeneity, where the folks in the airplane may, if you're traveling with measles, that gives you greater potential to transmit locally to a larger number of people, and that would show up in the dispersion of the chain size distribution if you look on the population level of cases, so sort of the outliers. So this method doesn't really look at worry about individual contact level dynamics. It's more about looking at an outbreak size as a whole. But you can see in that distribution, you can see evidence of super spreading. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Any more questions?
Great.
Okay, thank you.
You.